A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one for Male Mental Health Month. He wants to talk about the sexual side effects of psychiatric medications, specifically the three headline problems: loss of libido, erectile dysfunction, and anorgasmia. He's asking us to run through the prevalence, which agents are most likely to cause these issues, and the broad treatment options, including whether there are any straightforward medication swaps worth discussing with a doctor. And he's right. This is the stuff a lot of guys are too embarrassed to bring up.
They absolutely should bring it up, because the numbers here are staggering. Let's start with SSRIs, the most prescribed class by a mile. The prevalence of sexual dysfunction varies depending on how you measure it, but the best systematic reviews put it somewhere between 40 and 70% of patients. The most commonly cited figure comes from a meta-analysis of over 100 studies that found roughly 60% of people on SSRIs experience some form of treatment, emergent sexual dysfunction.
So, if you're sitting in a waiting room and there are 10 people there picking up their sertraline or fluoxetine, 6 of them are dealing with this, and I'm guessing most of them think they're the only one.
That's exactly the problem. And it's worse than that number suggests, because spontaneous reporting, just asking patients any side effects, captures maybe 14% of cases. When researchers use structured questionnaires, the rate jumps to 58-59%. Patients don't volunteer this information unless you ask directly and specifically.
Which is the clinical equivalent of how's the weather versus I notice you're limping, let's talk about the leg. And the 14% versus 58% gap, that's not a small discrepancy. That's a chasm.
It's a chasm built on shame. I remember a study out of the UK where they compared spontaneous reporting to the Arizona Sexual Experience Scale, which is a validated questionnaire that asks about drive, arousal, erection, orgasm. Very specific items. Very specific items. In the spontaneous report group, 14%. Same population, same drugs, same clinic, administer the ASIC scale, suddenly it's 59%. Nothing changed except the method of asking. The dysfunction was there all along.
The patients are sitting there, silently hoping the doctor will somehow intuit it and bring it up first. And the doctor is hoping the patient will volunteer it if it's actually a problem. And nobody says anything.
And the consultation moves on to sleep and appetite and whether they're back at work. The thing that might actually destroy their adherence to the medication never enters the room. So walk me through the three buckets Daniel mentioned. Libido first, what's actually happening there? Libido is driven substantially by dopamine, particularly in the mesolimbic pathway. That's the same reward circuitry that lights up for food, for social connection, for music you love. It's the brain's wanting system. SSRIs increase serotonin, and serotonin has an inhibitory effect on dopamine release. It's basically yanking the brake lever on your brain's reward and desire circuitry. But it's not just dopamine. Serotonin also suppresses testosterone production to some degree, and it dampens the activity of nitric oxide synthase, which is crucial for the physical side of things. The net effect is that the wanting part of the brain goes quiet.
It's not just, I can't, it's, I don't even want to, which in some ways is more disturbing to people.
And that's the part partners often misinterpret as loss of attraction. It's not about them, it's a neurochemical dampening of a whole motivational system. I've had patients tell me their partner was convinced they were having an affair or had fallen out of love because the absence of sexual interest read as rejection. And the patient couldn't explain it because they didn't understand it themselves. They just knew something was missing that used to be there.
That's heartbreaking. And it's a cascade. The side effect creates a relationship problem. The relationship problem worsens the depression. The worsened depression makes the side effect feel even more catastrophic. Now, erectile dysfunction is the second bucket, and that's where the nitric oxide part really matters. Nitric oxide is the molecule that relaxes smooth muscle in the corpus cavernosum, allowing blood to flow in and create an erection. Serotonin inhibits that pathway at multiple points. So you've got a direct physiological interference on top of the libido problem. Even if the wanting system were somehow intact, which it's not, the plumbing still might not cooperate.
And this is where the distinction between the three domains matters clinically. Some patients lose libido but can still perform mechanically if they get started. Some have normal desire but can't get an erection. Some have both but can't reach orgasm. You have to ask about each one separately because they have different mechanisms and different treatments. If you just ask any sexual problems, you're going to miss the nuance.
Anorgasmia rounds out the trio, which I gather is the most common of the three with SSRIs.
Delayed orgasm or complete inability to reach orgasm is reported by somewhere between 30 and 60% of SSRI users depending on the specific drug. The mechanism isn't fully worked out, but the leading theory involves serotonin's action on the spinal ejaculation generator. There's a cluster of neurons in the lumbar spinal cord that coordinates the whole reflex. Serotonin, particularly through the 5-HT1A and 5-HT2C receptors, puts the brakes on that circuit. It's why SSRIs are actually used off-label for premature ejaculation. The side effect is the treatment.
That is a very weird silver lining. Congratulations, your depression is better, and also you now last forever. I'm imagining the clinical trial where someone noticed this and thought, wait, that's a feature, not a bug.
It's genuinely one of those moments in pharmacology where a side effect becomes an indication. Duloxetine is an SSRI developed specifically for premature ejaculation, short half-life, taken on demand rather than daily. It's approved in Europe and several other countries, though not in the US. The whole premise is that you're deliberately inducing a mild anorgasmic effect for a couple of hours, which tells you how robust the mechanism is. If it works reliably enough to be a treatment for the opposite problem, the effect is real and powerful.
Let's do the rankings. Which drugs are the worst offenders?
Paroxetine is the heavyweight champion of sexual dysfunction, and nobody wants the belt. It has the highest rates across all three domains, libido, erectile function, and orgasm. One study found over 70% of patients on paroxetine reported sexual side effects. It's the most potent serotonin reuptake inhibitor in the class, and it also has some anticholinergic activity, which compounds the problem. After paroxetine, you've got sertraline and fluoxetine in the middle of the pack, and then citalopram and escitalopram tend to be somewhat better tolerated. But we're talking differences of degree, not kind. All SSRIs do this to some extent.
If someone's on paroxetine and they're struggling, is there any reason not to just switch immediately?
Paroxetine is also the hardest to discontinue because of its short half-life and the intensity of withdrawal symptoms. So you're dealing with a drug that has the worst sexual side effects and the worst discontinuation syndrome. It's a double penalty. That said, for some people, paroxetine is the only thing that controls their anxiety or depression, and they've tried other options. In that case, you manage the side effects rather than switching. But as a first-line agent, given what we know, it's hard to justify paroxetine when escitalopram or sertraline are available and generally better tolerated. SNRIs like venlafaxine and duloxetine have similar rates. Venlafaxine is pretty much on par with the mid-tier SSRIs. Duloxetine may be slightly less, but again, it's common. The real outliers on the high end are antipsychotics, which Daniel mentioned. Drugs like risperidone and haloperidol block dopamine D2 receptors, and since dopamine is the primary driver of libido and sexual arousal, you get profound suppression. Risperidone is notorious. It also dramatically elevates prolactin, which suppresses the hypothalamic-pituitary-gonadal axis. Men can develop gynecomastia, galactorrhea, complete loss of sexual function.
Wait, galactorrhea in men? That's a side effect from an antipsychotic?
It's uncommon, but it happens. Prolactin tells the mammary tissue to produce milk regardless of sex. It's one of those side effects that nobody talks about because it's so stigmatizing, but it's a real risk with risperidone and paliperidone. The prolactin-sparing antipsychotics, aripiprazole, cariprazole, lurasidone, are much better on sexual function because they're partial dopamine agonists rather than pure blockers.
I'm trying to imagine the conversation where a doctor has to explain to a male patient that his antipsychotic might cause him to lactate, and that this is a known thing.
It's a conversation that doesn't happen nearly enough. And think about the context. This is a patient who may already be dealing with psychosis, stigma, social isolation, maybe unemployment. Now you add a side effect that makes them feel like their body is betraying them in a profoundly gendered way. If nobody warned them, they think they're losing their mind in a whole new dimension. If someone did warn them, at least they know it's the medication and it's reversible. That's the difference between a manageable problem and a terrifying one.
Which brings us to the treatment options, and this is where the clinical picture gets interesting. The first and simplest intervention is a dose reduction. Sexual side effects from SSRIs are dose-dependent in many cases. If someone's on 40 milligrams of fluoxetine and doing well psychologically, dropping to 20 might preserve the antidepressant effect while reducing the sexual impairment. Before adding new drugs, just use less of the one you're on.
You'd be amazed how often this isn't tried. There's a clinical inertia once a dose is established. The prescription gets renewed at the same dose for months or years without anyone asking whether a lower dose might work just as well. The minimum effective dose concept sometimes gets lost in the rush of a 15-minute medication check. And with SSRIs, the dose response curve for efficacy is relatively flat above the minimum therapeutic dose, but the side effect curve keeps climbing. So you often get most of the benefit at a lower dose with a fraction of the side effects.
That flat dose response curve is one of those things that should change practice more than it does. The second approach is the drug holiday, taking a break for 2 or 3 days. This works for drugs with shorter half-lives like sertraline and paroxetine, though with paroxetine the withdrawal symptoms can be brutal. Fluoxetine has a half-life of 4 to 6 days, so a 2-day holiday is meaningless. It's still fully in your system. Then there's the weekend strategy, right? Where you time the break so the window of least impairment lines up with when you'd actually be sexually active.
It's not elegant, but for some people it works. You stop the sertraline on Thursday, the plasma level drops by Friday evening, you have a window through Sunday, and you resume Sunday night. By Monday morning, the drug is back to steady state. The risk, of course, is that you trigger withdrawal symptoms or a relapse of anxiety during those 2 or 3 days. Some people get the brain zaps, the dizziness, the irritability, and that's not exactly conducive to intimacy either.
It's a gamble. You're trading one kind of interference for another, with the hope that the timing works out.
And it's worth trying if the relationship strain is significant and the patient is stable enough to tolerate a brief interruption. But it's a stopgap, not a long-term strategy. The third approach is the one Daniel mentioned, augmentation with bupropion. Bupropion is a norepinephrine dopamine reuptake inhibitor, and it seems to counter some of the serotonergic dampening of sexual function. The data is mixed, but generally positive. A randomized controlled trial from the early 2000s found that adding bupropion SR at 150 milligrams twice daily significantly improved sexual function scores compared to placebo in people who had SSRI-induced dysfunction.
Bupropion is an antidepressant in its own right, so you're not just piling on a side effect management drug. You're getting additional therapeutic coverage.
Right, and bupropion itself has essentially no sexual side effects. In some studies, it actually improves sexual function in depressed patients compared to placebo, probably because it's boosting dopamine and norepinephrine. Some clinicians use it as a first-line antidepressant specifically for patients who are very concerned about sexual side effects. The downside is it can increase anxiety and it lowers the seizure threshold, so it's not for everyone.
How big a deal is the seizure risk in practice?
At therapeutic doses, the risk is about 1 in 1,000, roughly 4 times the background rate in the general population, but that's for the immediate release formulation. The extended release versions have somewhat lower peak plasma levels and may carry less risk. The people who really need to avoid bupropion are those with a history of seizures, eating disorders, or anything that already lowers the seizure threshold, alcohol withdrawal for instance. But for an otherwise healthy person without those risk factors, the absolute risk is low enough that it shouldn't be a barrier if the drug is otherwise a good fit.
What about sildenafil and tadalafil, the PDE5 inhibitors? If the problem is specifically erectile, do those work when the cause is serotonergic?
They do, and this is an important distinction. PDE5 inhibitors work downstream of the nitric oxide pathway. So even though serotonin is suppressing nitric oxide production, if you boost the downstream signaling by blocking PDE5, you can partially overcome the blockade. Several randomized controlled trials have shown that sildenafil improves erectile function and overall sexual satisfaction in men with SSRI-induced erectile dysfunction. It doesn't do much for libido or orgasm, but for the mechanical problem, it's effective.
You've got a pharmacological workaround for one of the three problems, but it's a workaround that doesn't touch the other two. If someone's libido is flatlined, getting an erection isn't really the point. There's no desire driving it.
And that's the limitation. PDE5 inhibitors require some degree of sexual stimulation to work. They amplify the natural arousal signal, but they don't create one from mething. If the serotonergic dampening has shut down the wanting system completely, sildenafil might produce a physically functional erection that the person has no psychological interest in using, which is its own kind of strange and distressing experience.
You're physically capable but mentally absent. That sounds almost dissociative. What about anorgasmia specifically? Anything that helps with that?
This is the hardest one to treat pharmacologically. Some small studies have looked at cyproheptadine, which is a serotonin antagonist. It blocks some of the same receptors that SSRIs stimulate. Taken an hour or two before sexual activity, it can sometimes reverse the orgasmic delay. But it's also an antihistamine, so it causes sedation, and it can reverse the antidepressant effect if used regularly. Buspirone, which is a partial serotonin agonist, has some evidence too, but it's weak. Really, the most reliable intervention for anorgasmia is switching to an antidepressant with a different mechanism.
Which brings us to the swap-out conversation. If someone's on paroxetine and can't tolerate the sexual side effects, what are the alternatives that are better?
The standout is bupropion, as we said. No significant sexual side effects at all, and possibly pro-sexual. Mirtazapine is another option. It's a noradrenergic and specific serotonergic antidepressant. It blocks certain serotonin receptors rather than flooding the whole system. Sexual dysfunction rates with mirtazapine are similar to placebo. The trade-offs are sedation and weight gain, which can be significant.
Sedation and weight gain versus sexual dysfunction. That's a difficult calculus.
And it's why these conversations need to be individualized. For some people, weight gain is more distressing than sexual dysfunction. For others, it's the reverse. There's no universal hierarchy of side effect tolerability. I've had patients who said, "I'd rather be fat and functional in bed than thin and dead inside." And I've had patients who said the exact opposite. The point is to have the conversation so the patient can make their own trade-off.
Vilazodona and vortioxetine are newer serotonergic drugs with different receptor profiles. Vilazodona is an SSRI plus a partial 5-HT1A agonist, and vortioxetine has a multimodal profile that includes receptor modulation. Both appear to have lower rates of sexual dysfunction than traditional SSRIs, though not zero. In head-to-head studies, vortioxetine showed significantly less treatment emergent sexual dysfunction than escitalopram. Vortioxetine is the one to watch if you're trying to stay in the serotonergic family but want a better side effect profile.
It's a strong contender. The multimodal mechanism is different. It's not just a reuptake inhibitor, it also modulates several serotonin receptor subtypes directly. The 5-HT3 antagonism, for instance, seems to have pro-cognitive effects and may indirectly benefit sexual function by reducing some of the inhibitory signaling. The downside is cost. Vortioxetine is still on patent in most places, so insurance coverage can be a barrier.
What about the MAOIs or tricyclics? I know they're older, but do they have different side effect profiles on this front?
Tricyclics are all over the map. Clomipramine, which is very serotonergic, has high rates of sexual dysfunction. Some studies put it even higher than paroxetine, which is really saying something. Desipramine and nortriptyline, which are more noradrenergic, are somewhat better. MAOIs are interesting. Phenazine and tranylcypramine can cause significant sexual dysfunction, but selegiline, especially the transdermal patch at lower doses, seems to have lower rates. But MAOIs come with dietary restrictions and hypertensive crisis risks, so they're rarely a first-line swap.
The transdermal patch is an interesting delivery mechanism. Does bypassing the gut actually change the side effect profile that much?
At lower doses, the patch selectively inhibits MAOB in the brain without hitting MAOA in the gut, which is the enzyme that breaks down tyramine. So you get the antidepressant effect without the hypertensive crisis risk from eating cheese or cured meats. At higher doses, it loses that selectivity and you're back to dietary restrictions. but the lower dose patch does seem to have a better sexual side effect profile than the oral MAOIs, and it's an option that's probably underutilized.
If I'm a patient and I'm sitting across from my doctor, what's the most practical, evidence-based sequence here? I'm on an SSRI. I'm getting the side effects. I want to address them. Walk me through the decision tree.
Step 1. Confirm it's actually the drug. Depression itself causes sexual dysfunction. Loss of libido is a core symptom. So you need to establish that the dysfunction started or worsened after beginning the medication. If the depression came with sexual dysfunction and the medication hasn't changed it, the problem might be the illness, not the treatment. Step 2. Try dose reduction if the clinical picture allows it. Step 3. If that doesn't work or isn't appropriate, consider a drug holiday if the half-life supports it. Step 4. Add bupropion or a PDE5 inhibitor depending on which domain is most affected. Step 5. Switch to a lower-risk agent, bupropion, mirtazapine, vortioxetine, or vilazodone.
That's a clean algorithm, and I noticed just tough it out isn't on the list.
It shouldn't be. And this is where the male mental health angle Daniel raised really matters. Men are already socialized not to talk about sexual problems. Add depression, which tells you you're worthless and nothing will help, and add a medication that physically impairs sexual function, and you've got a perfect storm for silent suffering and non-adherence. The number one reason people stop taking antidepressants in the first 6 months is sexual side effects. Not lack of efficacy, side effects. So if we don't address this, we're undermining the treatment itself.
That statistic alone should make every prescriber sit up. You're not doing someone a favor by ignoring the thing that's going to make them quit the drug that's keeping them alive.
The fallout goes beyond the individual. Partners feel rejected. The patient feels broken and defective. It feeds back into the depression. There's a paper from the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry that found sexual dysfunction from antidepressants was associated with significantly lower quality of life scores, even when the depression itself was in remission. So you've treated the depression, but you've created a new source of suffering.
That's the cruelest trade-off. Congratulations, you no longer want to die. Also, a fundamental part of being human is now offline.
We haven't even touched on the post-SSRI sexual dysfunction question, the PSSD community. There are people who report that sexual side effects persist for months or years after stopping the medication. The medical establishment was slow to acknowledge this, but the European Medicines Agency now recognizes persistent sexual dysfunction as a potential adverse effect of SSRIs and SNRIs. The physiology isn't well understood. Some researchers think it might involve epigenetic changes or persistent receptor desensitization.
The reversal isn't always guaranteed. That raises the stakes substantially.
Though it's worth saying that the prevalence of true PSSD is unknown and probably low. Most people do recover after discontinuation, but the fact that some don't is something patients deserve to know up front. Informed consent means knowing the range of possible outcomes, including the rare ones.
I imagine the PSSD community has been pretty vocal about feeling dismissed by the medical establishment.
With good reason. For years, the standard response was, that can't happen, or it must be the depression returning. Patients were gaslit by the very profession that was supposed to help them. The EMA acknowledgement was a watershed moment because it validated what patients had been saying for decades. The science is still catching up, but at least the question is now taken seriously.
Let's circle back to antipsychotics for a moment, because the mechanism there is different, and the management is different too. You mentioned the prolactin-sparing ones. How much of a difference does that actually make?
It's night and day. Aripiprazole and cariprazine are partial agonists at the D2 receptor. They stimulate it just enough to prevent the complete dopamine blockade that causes hyperprolactinemia and sexual dysfunction. In clinical trials, the sexual side effect rates with aripiprazole are close to placebo. The trade-off is that partial agonists can be less effective for positive symptoms of schizophrenia in some patients, and they can cause akathisia, that horrible inner restlessness that makes you feel like you want to crawl out of your skin.
Akathisia is one of those side effects that's hard to describe to someone who hasn't experienced it. It's not pain. It's not anxiety. It's a physical compulsion to move that never resolves.
It's a major reason people stop taking aripiprazole. So you're trading one tolerability problem for another. For some people, the akathisia is worse than the sexual dysfunction. For others, it's the reverse.
If switching isn't an option, say someone needs to stay on risperidone because it's the only thing controlling their symptoms.
Adding aripiprazole to risperidone can sometimes help. The partial agonist competes with the full blocker at the receptor and can reduce prolactin levels. There are studies showing this works for risperidone-induced hyperprolactinemia. Phosphodiesterase inhibitors can help with the erectile component, just like with SSRIs. And for the libido loss, there's unfortunately not much that reliably works when the cause is dopamine blockade.
For antipsychotic-induced sexual dysfunction, the libido piece is the hardest to fix. Which makes sense. If you're blocking the desire pathway at the receptor level, there's only so much you can do downstream.
And this gets at a broader point about how we think about side effects in psychiatry. There's a tendency to rank them. Well, sexual dysfunction is unpleasant, but it's not life-threatening. But for the patient, it might be the thing that makes life not worth living. It might destroy their marriage. It might make them stop taking the medication that prevents psychotic episodes. The clinical attitude of minimizing sexual side effects is not just callous, it's counterproductive.
You practiced medicine in Jerusalem for years. How did you handle these conversations with patients?
Badly at first, if I'm honest. I was trained in an era where the standard line was, the side effects will probably pass, give it time. And for some people that's true, there's a subset of patients who develop sexual dysfunction in the first weeks and it resolves spontaneously. But for most, it persists. Over time, I learned to bring it up proactively, use direct language, and make it clear that this was a legitimate medical problem we would work on together. I'd say something like, this medication can affect your sex life in three ways: your interest in sex, your ability to get and keep an erection, and your ability to reach orgasm. Any of these happen, tell me, and we'll adjust the plan. There are options. Just putting it on the table changed the dynamic completely.
There are options. Three words that probably did more for adherence than any amount of cajoling about the importance of taking your medication.
And I want to emphasize that the phrasing matters. If you say any problems in the bedroom, you're being euphemistic and the patient will match your level of vagueness. If you say some people notice changes in their ability to get an erection or reach orgasm, has anything like that happened for you? You're normalizing it and being specific. The patient understands that you've had this conversation before, that you're comfortable with it, and that they're not going to shock you.
There's a skill to making the clinical feel conversational, and the options keep improving. One thing I want to mention is that there's emerging interest in bremelanotide and other melanocortin agonists for sexual dysfunction. Bremelanotide is currently approved for hypoactive sexual desire disorder in premenopausal women, but it works through a completely different pathway. It activates melanocortin receptors in the hypothalamus, which modulates dopamine release in a way that enhances sexual motivation. It's not approved for SSRI-induced dysfunction, but there's research interest. The pipeline isn't empty. But for someone listening right now, today, who's dealing with this? What's the one thing you'd want them to know?
That this is common, it's not your fault, it's not a reflection on your masculinity or your relationship, and your doctor has heard it before. You're not going to shock anyone. And if your doctor dismisses it or tells you to just deal with it, find another doctor. The standard of care has evolved. Sexual side effects are treatable, and addressing them is part of treating the whole person, not an optional extra.
I think that's the core of it. The side effect is not the price you pay for being broken. It's a problem with a solution, or at least a mitigation, and you deserve both the conversation and the attempt.
Maybe the broader point for Male Mental Health Month is that seeking help for depression takes courage, and staying on treatment when the side effects are eroding your quality of life takes a different kind of courage. But you don't have to choose between your mental health and your sexuality. With the right approach, you can protect both.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1970s, a linguist working in Kyrgyzstan noticed that Linear A and Linear B tablets, when photographed under infrared light, revealed distinct optical properties. Linear B's phonetic symbols absorbed infrared differently than Linear A's logographic ones, a difference invisible to the naked eye that helped confirm they encode fundamentally different languages.
Infrared analysis of Bronze Age clay tablets in Kyrgyzstan. Of course there are. The takeaway here, and I mean this seriously, is that the conversation about sexual side effects is the treatment gap that keeps people silently non-adherent. Closing that gap costs nothing but a few direct questions and a willingness to adjust the plan.
The plan always has adjustments available. bupropion, mirtazapine, vortioxetine, dose reduction, drug holidays, PDE5 inhibitors. There is a menu of options, not a binary choice between suffering and stopping.
This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com or on Spotify. If this episode helped you or someone you know, a review wherever you listen makes a real difference. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.